ಮಂಜನಾಯ ರಮಣ ತೀರಾವನ ರಮಣ ತೀರಾವನ
Vishnupad, Paramahamsa, Parabrajagachara, Sotir, Siddhashi, Shimanis Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Iskan Founder Chari, Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda, all glories to Simla devotees, all glories to Simla devotees, all glories to Simla devotees, all glories to Shri Guru and Shri Guranda. Ma Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Sai Vidaya Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamani Namaste Sarasa Devam Gaura Randa Bichani Nivashe Shishun Vada Kastra Chari Sipani Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 17, Text 39. Grihārti sadrśim bhāryām. Do I have the right one? No? Okay, what happened here? Which one's this one? Okay, this is, I thought we covered this. Does this look familiar? Or are they all sounding sound alike? No, we did 37. We did 37. We're on 39. Okay. Text 39. Grihārti sadrśim bhāryām udvahed ujagupsitam yaviyashim tuvayasa yangsavarnam anukramat Grihārti sadrśim bhāryām udvahed ujagupsitam yaviyasim tuvayasa yang savarnam anukramat Grihārti sadrśim bhāryām Udvahed ujagupsitam Yaviyasim tuvayasa Yang savarnam anukramat
Yavi Yasim Tuvayasa, 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 Yavi Yasim T
Griha. Household. Arti. One who desires. Sadrishim. Possessing similar characteristics. Baryam. A wife. Udvahet. One should marry. Ujagupsitam. Beyond reproach. Yavi Yasim. Younger. Two. Indeed. Vayasa. By age. Yam. Another wife. Savarnam. The first wife who is of the same caste. Anu. After. Kramat. In succession. Oh, I did forget to mention this is the appearance or disappearance day of Srila Madhvacharya. So we'll talk a little bit about this verse in purport, and then we'll talk about Madhvacharya. Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. One who desires to establish family life should marry a wife of his own caste, who is beyond reproach and younger in age. If one desires to accept many wives, he must marry them after the first marriage, and each wife should be of successively lower caste. Important instructions for all of you. Purport. As stated in the Vedic literature, Tisro varnan upur vyena dveta haika yata kramam brahman chatriya visham bharya spa shudra janmana. The purport of this verse is that one's first wife must always be sadrisham, or similar to oneself. In other words, an intellectual man should marry an intellectual wife, a heroic man should marry a heroic wife, a businessman should marry a woman who can encourage him in such activities, and a shudra should marry a less intelligent woman. The wife must be beyond reproach in terms of her background and character, and should always be younger than oneself, ideally 5 to 10 years younger. If one desires to marry a second wife, then as stated in this verse by the word varnanu purvyena, and in the verse spoken by Lord Krishna by the word anukramat, one must wait until the first marriage is established and then select a second wife from the next lower caste. If one marries a third time, the wife must be again from the next lower caste. For example, a Brahmin's first wife will be a Brahmini, his second wife from the Kshatriya community, his third wife from the Vaishya community, and a fourth wife from the Shudra community. A Kshatriya may marry a Kshatriya lady and then a Vaishya and a Shudra lady. A Vaishya can accept wives from two classes, and a Shudra may accept a wife from only the Shudra class. By this progression of marriages, there will be relative peace in the family. These Vedic injunctions, as mentioned in the previous verse, are especially for those who are not pure devotees of the Lord. Om Gyanatim Randisha Gananjana Salakaya Tak Chakshurunimitamina Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha Vanchukopat Yubhisha Kripa Sindhu Vyevicha Patitano Pavanevya Vaishmi Guru Namaha. So I think the final line of this purport is important. These instructions are meant for those who are not pure devotees. And I think we could also say those who are following the line of pure devotional service, who are striving to become pure devotees under the guidance of pure devotees. And we can see that these instructions are probably also not so applicable in Kali Yuga. And Prabhupada made several comments about that. Now, it's kind of interesting because our scriptures do mention polygamy. It's mentioned several places, and it certainly was accepted as part of Vedic culture, which say at least Varnashram culture. And it had a certain purpose within the social order. And there were very strict rules following that, as we can see here, of how that was set up and how it would be executed. Now, these things are really very, very difficult for people in Kali Yuga to follow, all of these Vedic injunctions, all of these Varnashram rules and regulations, and therefore they're not so much stressed. Because polygamy is mentioned several times in the scriptures, and we have pastimes of kings, especially the Kshatriya class, having more than one wife, which is quite common. Of course, Krishna himself has 16,108 wives. So naturally, devotees were interested in this. And I remember particularly back in the 70s, there was a little wave of where some devotees were taking second wives, etc. And historically, I would say it was a disaster. I don't remember too many good outcomes. Maybe there were one or two that worked, but the only ones that I knew of really did not work well. And finally, there's a point, and especially Prabhupada wrote several letters in 1975, 1976, that area, and Prabhupada said, absolutely, this cannot be done. I just want, just to be clear on this, I looked up a few letters that Prabhupada wrote. This is from 76, November, Prabhupada said, and this is a temple president who ran off with another woman and then said, oh, she's my second wife. Yeah. Prabhupada said, this incident with our temple president is not good. He can't even maintain one wife. Just see how lusty he is. Now he'll dare to take another. Anyway, he cannot live in the temple. So Prabhupada was very heavy. And Prabhupada also said, regarding the question of second marriage, this is another letter, it cannot be done. Neither the law will not allow it, and neither can we encourage it. If they want to marry more than one wife, they must live outside the temple and make their own arrangement. Of course, that's illegal. Within the society, only one marriage can be allowed. And Prabhupada said, I thought these boys and girls would be married and be happy. Prabhupada was so optimistic about this. He says, but I see they are not satisfied. In the Western countries, they are trained up in a different way, jumping from one to another. Another wife, another husband. This is the disease all over the world. Simply by agreement, then canceling, then another agreement. So Prabhupada also is indicating the idea of, well, not taking a second wife, but then like leaving the first one, marrying again, or the vice versa, the wife leaving the husband, remarrying, and this going on successively was also not pleasing to him. Prabhupada said, regarding your taking a second wife, this is another letter, you cannot do this. At least you cannot stay in our temple in Vrindavan. Our temple cannot support you and your two wives. You will want three or four or more. Anyway, as an American, it is illegal for you to do this. And then Prabhupada said, we are trying to minimize sex and you are trying to increase it. Please give up this idea. So Prabhupada soon saw that our sort of Western contamination led to this sort of, you know, philosophical or socially accepted idea of polygamy was simply another excuse to increase our sex desire and lust. And as Prabhupada said, people are not prepared in this age to even hardly take care of one wife and one family nicely, what to speak of multiple. So that's the end of that. No polygamy. But we can take instruction from this purport, as we can from all of these wonderful instructions, because they're coming from Krishna. And one of the instructions that, at least that I got from this, is this idea that one should actually marry one of a similar nature. This is actually very good advice, this idea of marrying within the same varna or the same group, because it actually tends to be more successful. And this is something I've done some studying of, and even the research on this finds that compatibility does help in relationships. Relationships are enhanced if there are similarities, and particularly it's found that the more similarities there are than differences is more helpful. Not that there can't be differences. Sometimes that's fine. They can also be complementary. But often those who have similarities in background, in values, and personality characteristics will tend to do better. And one of the important things, I think, for us as devotees to think about is when we talk about values, is spiritual values. Because I've even found in my own experience with marriage counseling like that couples who share spiritual ideals, spiritual values, and commitment to Krishna consciousness tend to do better. You know, if you're on a similar level, if a couple is on very different levels, or one is very committed to Krishna consciousness and the other partner is not, it usually leads to difficulties. And those are harder relationships to keep together and keep them happily going forward. In fact, there is research, there was a study of 24,000 couples, and they found that 89% of those couples who agreed on the importance of spirituality in their marriage were happily married. So, I mean, even within the material world, this is a very important concept, what to speak of devotees, that if there is some compatibility in our spiritual values and our commitment to Krishna consciousness, it's going to help greatly. So that's something that, you know, when we're obviously advising young people who are thinking about marriage or entering into relationship, sometimes they don't realize how important that is, because often there's attraction, infatuation in the beginning, and we think, oh, the person's sort of somehow in this category of a devotee, you know, but as we know, there are many levels of commitment to devotional service, and young people particularly, you know, need to understand that it's important that they're going to share similar values, you know. And it's almost, well, I don't want to recommend this, but it's almost like if they're both on a lower level or both on a higher level, it's, you know, it kind of works better than one being on one and one being on the other. Anyway, enough of that. Similar commitment to Krishna consciousness is a critical in relationship, particularly marriage. Now, it's interesting about, we've been discussing Varnashram here for 39 verses, and we have a whole other chapter on Varnashram coming up after this one. And we've discussed Brahmachari life and many things in great detail, and particularly the renounced order of life. But yet, in one sense, the Varnashram system, as described here in this verse and in the previous verse, it said this is not necessarily meant for those whose aspirations are for pure devotional service. In yesterday's verse, it's the final line of verse 38 was, one who is not surrendered to me should move progressively from one ashram to another, never acting otherwise. In other words, the systematic progression through ashrams is particularly meant for those who are not on the path of pure devotional service. So it's kind of, how do we reconcile this? Well, there's two different ideas. There's the idea of pure devotional service, and then there's Varnashram. Or we could say there is Varnashram and Daivi Varnashram, the idea of, you know, systematically leading to spiritual progression to the platform of pure devotional service. So we know that according to Bhagavad Gita 4.15, Krishna instituted this process of Varnashram. He says, according to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, you know, that's qualities and work, not by birth, the four divisions of human society are created by me. And although I am the creator of the system, you should know I am the non-doer, being unchangeable. So varnas are defined as guna and karma, one's quality and one work, not by janma or birth. And we can see examples of how birth does not necessarily determine one's position. We had example, a very dramatic example of King Vena, who was a Kshatriya by birth and was from a good Kshatriya family. And he was a demon. He did not act as a Kshatriya. He did not protect the people. He exploited the people. So his qualities did not match up with his birth. And then we heard this story just 2 days ago, the appearance day of Advaitacharya. How Advaitacharya sort of went against the Brahminical class. And when he was offering the Shraddha ceremony, he offered the honored plate to Haridas Thakur, who had no place in the Varnashram system. He was an outcast. He was a Muslim. You know, he was from a Malecha, meat-eating family. So Advaitacharya showed, who is Mahavishnu himself, that, you know, the Varnashram system is limited in its material application. If one is a devotee, it has nothing to do with this. One is beyond all conceptions of Varna and Ashram. So in the famous discussion between Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Ramananda Roy, Lord Chaitanya asked Ramananda to tell him what is the essence of religious principles, what is the highest. And of course, we know he went through many different steps, leading finally to pure devotional service. And Lord Chaitanya rejected all of these, although they were scripturally correct. Lord Chaitanya did not really appreciate so much what he considered more materialistic or external applications of the scriptures. So one of the first things Ramananda presented to him was this quote from Vishnu Purana: the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, is worshipped by the proper execution of prescribed duties in the system of Varna and Ashram. There is no other way to satisfy the Personality of Godhead. One must be situated in the institution of the four Varnas and Ashrams. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, this is external, tell me more. And so he didn't really think that was, you know, critical. And Prabhupada explains in the purport, this is Mudja 860, Srila Prabhupada says, Ramananda Roy first enunciated the principle of Varnashram Dharma in consideration of materialistic people. However, this conception is not transcendental. As long as one is in the material world, he must follow the principles of Varnashram Dharma. But devotional service is transcendental. The system of Varnashram Dharma refers to the three modes of material nature, but transcendental devotional service is on the absolute platform. So, and of course, eventually Lord Chaitanya accepted Ramananda Roy's, when he came to the point of pure devotional service, then of course he went progressively through all the rasas up to the final, the highest platform of separation of Madhurya Leela. So Varnashram Dharma has value, though, when it's aimed at the service of Krishna. And it is described that it was, in fact, in the verse that Ramananda Roy first quoted, he said that one can be situated in Varnashram Dharma as a means of achieving Krishna. But if it doesn't connect with Krishna, then it has no real value in itself. Even the Bhagavatam 1.2.8 says, the occupational activities of a man performs according to his own position, that was his position in Varnashram Dharma, are only so much useless labor if they do not provoke attraction for the message of the personality of Godhead. So the idea is Varnashram Dharma is meant to systematically lead people to Krishna consciousness, to pure devotional service. If it's not doing that, then it's of no value. And we can see that how sometimes there's been perversions of that, particularly the caste system in India, which takes the principles of Varnashram and actually twists them in a materialistic way, and we see very, very bad results. So it's not that there's really a conflict between our doing one's dharma or acting in Varnashram and devotional service. Because in human life, we need to control material desires, we need to control our senses, we need to act appropriately for the value of an orderly society, to perform according to religious principles and create an orderly society. So a Varnashram system is necessary. And it's necessary for those who do not take to the process of pure devotional service to have a way of making advancement. Now, the way of being situated where they are working under Brahmins and hopefully Kshatriyas or leaders who are Krishna conscious, they can help the whole society to advance. So, bhakti or pure devotional service, as mentioned in these verses, is above these principles. So which do we follow? Well, we follow both. We understand that the highest principle is devotional service, but at the same time, we do need to follow dharmic principles as long as we are in this material body, as long as we have duty within this material world. And when one becomes more advanced, one doesn't give up all those principles, one follows to set example for others, just as we see in the process of sadhana bhakti. When one is on the Vaidhi Bhakti platform, one follows according to the rules and regulations because one knows one needs to do that out of a sense of duty. And when one progresses to Raghunuga Bhakti and higher stages, one still performs one sadhana to set example for others. And also just because those practices themselves become relishable. In other words, we might rise early in the morning chant Hare Krishna because that's the order of the spiritual master, but eventually as we make advancement, we actually appreciate and we get taste from those activities. So we continue those activities, we don't give them up because they are both the means and the end. So with the system of dharma, religious principles, Varnashram, it's not that we give up all these things. You know, we observe them. In fact, we support them. We try to promote them as ways that the whole society can advance. Final quote I have, or pastime, I guess, is from Bhakti Chiru Swami. He was with Srila Prabhupada during his last days of life. And he told me the story, and I asked him two or three times to repeat it just to make sure I had it right. So I've heard this at least twice, if not three times, from Bhakti Chiru Swami. He was with Prabhupada, and I forget the context of the discussion where Bhakti Chiru Swami was talking about should we establish Varnashram. And Srila Prabhupada said very clearly to him, he said, Varnashram is for the outsiders, not for the devotees. Which is quite interesting, because Prabhupada also spent much time in the last couple of years of his life talking about Varnashram and trying to establish Varnashram and talking about its importance, and particularly in our farm communities. So it's not that these aren't important. The idea of developing self-sufficient farm communities is very important. But the idea of establishing a strict Varnashram order is something that's probably very difficult to do and not as important for the devotees who are committed to the process of pure devotional service. Okay? So, I am going to, I'm sure there are questions, comments, corrections, or challenges, but we're going to move on, because this is the appearance or disappearance?
Disappearance.
Disappearance of Madhvacharya, who is such an important acharya in our line. We are part of the Gaudiya Brahma Madhva Sampradaya. So this is our Sampradaya leader, our acharya, Madhvacharya. And first I'm going to read a verse from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Majjhima 9.246. Madhvacharya stane aila yanhe tatvavadi Urupiti Krishna Deki Tahan Haila Premon Madi. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu next arrived in Udupi, in the place of Madhvacharya, where the philosophers known as Tattvavadis resided. There he saw the deity of Lord Krishna and became mad with ecstasy. Now I'm going to come back to this because in the purport, Srila Prabhupada gives a long, long description of Madhvacharya's pastimes, which are really wonderful. So I'm going to come back to that and read Prabhupada's purport where he describes the pastimes of Madhvacharya. First, just a little more background. I'm taking this, what I'm reading, there's from some Back to Godhead articles and a couple things that I took from ISKCON Desire Tree, which I'm assuming are bona fide. But anyway, if there are any discrepancies, we can blame them. So, well, I had to get it from somewhere, right? Madhvacharya's learning and devotion to Krishna were famous throughout India. His life's mission was to defeat the views of the impersonalist philosophers. Madhvacharya smashed the monist's idea with the philosophy of Shuddha Dvaita, pure dualism. He proved logically that God is always a person and always distinct from his creations. Now we know that there's the four main acharyas and four different variations on this idea. Which is against impersonalism, which explains the personalist conception of God, and a sort of progression in their advancement, a little bit subtly from Madhvacharya through the others, onto Lord Chaitanya's fullest elaboration of Achintya Veda Tattva. Anyway, so I'm not going to get into that. That's another class, and someone else can give that one. But at any rate, Madhvacharya is promoted dualism, where he very clearly enunciated that God and the living entity are different. They're not one. Madhvacharya taught the soul is actually the eternal servant of Krishna, and that by practicing bhakti yoga devotional service, each of us can return to our original position in the spiritual world. Madhvacharya especially emphasized that even after the individual soul returns to the spiritual world, he and the Supreme Lord Krishna retain their separate identities. They do not become one. Now, why is this? Why was this so important? Like we say, well, yeah, right, of course, we're not one. We're all Krishna and living entity. Because Shankaracharya's teaching, Shankaracharya appeared, about 200 years earlier? And he established Mayavadi philosophy very strongly throughout India. So all of India was Mayavadi, basically. I mean, there's little pockets of devotees, of Vaishnavs. So Madhvacharya had to establish this philosophy very strongly to defeat Shankaracharya and Mayavadi philosophy, and which he was very successful in doing. Madhvacharya's nine teachings, nine basic principles he taught. One, Sri Krishna alone is the supreme absolute truth, one without a second. Two, he is the object of knowledge in all the Vedas. The universe is real, satya. The difference between Ishvara, Jiva, and matter, Prakriti, are real. Five, Jiva souls are by nature the servants of the Supreme Lord Hari. Six, there are two categories of Jivas, liberated and illusioned, or conditioned. Seven, liberation means attaining the lotus feet of Bhagavan Krishna. In other words, entering into eternal relationship in the service of the Supreme Lord. Eight, pure devotional service to Krishna is the only way to attain this liberation. And nine, the truth may be known by prajaksha, direct perception, anuman, inference, or logic, or shabda, spiritual sound, or Vedic authority. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I think we can all accept these wonderful nine principles that Madhvacharya enunciated. And in fact, thoroughly establishes this in the face of Mayavadi philosophy. Madhva prepared the way for Lord Chaitanya, who appeared two centuries later in the same line of spiritual masters. The Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya originates with the Madhvas. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers thoroughly studied Madhva's work before compiling their philosophy. For the Sat Sandarbhas, Sri Jiva Goswami drew heavily from Madhva's writings, etc. And Sri Chaitanya himself visited Udupi, the seat of the Madhva sect, and the Lord introduced Harinam Sankirtan into their sect. He, of course, we know from those pastimes in the Madhyalila, he had a very strong influence on the Madhvavadis and really converted them at that point. And also remember that Madhvacharya's commentaries, particularly on Srimad Bhagavatam, are considered like the original commentaries. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu referred to them, the Madhvacharya's commentaries, as sort of being the gold standard. And we know that Srila Prabhupada used basically five Acharya's commentaries, I think five primarily, when he wrote his commentaries. And Madhvacharya, of course, is often quoted in Prabhupada's works. Like Madhvacharya's, from what I understand, I haven't seen them or translation or read them, but I think Bhanuswami was telling me that Madhvacharya didn't comment on every verse like some of the commentators, but he would, you know, write occasional commentaries on groups of Bhagavatam verses, you know, enunciating the philosophy, and Srila Prabhupada drew upon this as one of his sources of inspiration. Okay, so now this purport is from 9246 Madhyalila. And at the end of it, Srila Prabhupada actually didn't write it. He quotes that this was found, this was printed somewhere in some journal or something. So it's not actually Prabhupada's. Prabhupada included in the purport, so it's Prabhupada's, but the original writing was from some Bombay journal or something on the life of Madhvacharya. So it must be accurate because Prabhupada approved it. Srimad Madhvacharya, I have added a little bit, but I've got most of it here. I think I've got time. Sripad Madhvacharya took his birth near Udupi, which is situated in the South Karnataka district of South India. Kanara, is that different than Karnataka? Kanara district. Okay, near the city of Udupi is a place called Pachakachetra, where Madhvacharya took his birth in a Shivali Brahmin dynasty as a son of Majjigeha Bhatta in the year 1040 Shakabda AD 1118. According to some, he was born in the year Shakabda 1160, corresponding with 1238. From what I found, looking up two or three sources, most sources use 1238 as the date. I saw that more often than the 1118. So it's 100 years difference, so I'm not sure. But, you know, I don't think people took, you know, really noted time and dates very well, or wasn't that important during that time. Anyway, 1238 is probably the year of his birth. And he lived about 70 years, I think. Anyway. And this, of course, being his disappearance day. Here's some pastimes. In his childhood, Madhvacharya was known as Vasudeva, then later he was called Purnaprajna, and sometimes he's called Anandatirtha. And there's some wonderful stories surrounding him. It is said that once when his father had piled up many dates, Madhvacharya converted tamarind seeds into actual coins to pay them off. When he was 5 years old, he was offered the sacred thread. A demon named Maniman lived near his abode in the form of a snake, and at the age of five, Madhvacharya killed that snake with the toe of his left foot. This was a big demon snake. When his mother was very much disturbed, he would appear before her in one jump. Now, he apparently was very good at this jumping. So I've seen some places that he was considered to be an incarnation of Vayu.
Yes.
Is that true? Is that what most of you, you know? Okay. I didn't see Prabhupada didn't say that specifically, but I've seen in other sources he's considered an incarnation of Vayu. He was a great scholar even in childhood, and although his father did not agree, he accepted sannyas at the age of 12. Upon receiving sannyas from Achyuta Prajna, he received the name Purnaprajna Tirtha. After traveling all over India, he finally discussed scriptures with Vijayashankara, the exalted leader of the Sringeri Math. Vijayashankara was actually diminished in the presence of Madhvacharya. Accompanied by Satyatirtha, Madhvacharya went to Bhadrak Ashram. It was there he met Vyasadeva and explained his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita before him. Thus, he became a great scholar by studying before Vyasadeva. Isn't that interesting to go to Vyasadeva and give his commentary? Who would dare to do that? You know, obviously, but Vyasadeva was quite impressed. And now, and that is why in our Sampradaya, we see it comes down and it says Vyasadeva, and then it says Madhvacharya, right? In other words, he's listed. I mean, there are others in there, but what, you know, sometimes you think, well, why there's a 4,000-year gap here? Well, that gap is covered because Vyasadeva was still residing in the Himalayas. Of course, he's, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of years he's able to live as a such a great exalted devotee and obviously a great mystic yogi. And so Madhvacharya traveled all the way up to Bhadrakashram, you know, wherever it is. About, how high is it? About 17,000 feet elevation or something? Anyway, it's very, you know, it's up very high in the Himalayas. And so, now I don't think, most of us probably would not be able to see Vyasadeva and take darshan of him, but Madhvacharya, because of being such an exalted devotee, was able to do so and study with him. Therefore, he is considered, he is next in the line from Vyasadeva. By the time he came to the Ananda Math from Bhadrakashram, Madhvacharya had finished his commentary on Bhagavad Gita. His companion Satyatirtha wrote down the entire commentary. When Madhvacharya returned from Bhadrakashram, he went to Gunjama, which is on the bank of the river Godavari. There he met with two learned scholars named Shobhanabhatta and Swami Shastri. Later, these scholars became known in the disciplic succession of Madhvacharya as Padmanabhatirtha and Narahariyatirtha. I think they're listed, aren't they, in our disciplic succession. When he returned to Udupi, he would sometimes bathe in the ocean. On such an occasion, he composed a prayer in five chapters while taking a bath. Once while sitting beside the sea, engrossed in meditation upon Lord Sri Krishna, he saw a large boat containing goods for Dwarka that was in danger. He gave some signs by which the boat could approach the shore, and it was saved. The owners of the boat wanted to give him a present, and at that time, Madhvacharya agreed to take some Gopi Chandan, which seems like a very minor thing, a big lump of clay. Okay, that's all you want. You know, he received a big lump of Gopi Chandan and it was brought to him. It broke apart and revealed a large deity of Lord Krishna. The deity had a stick in one hand and a lump of food in the other. As soon as Madhvacharya received the deity of Krishna in this way, he composed a prayer. The deity was so heavy that even 30 people could not lift it. Yet Madhvacharya personally brought this deity to Udupi. Eight of Madhvacharya's sannyas disciples became directors of his eight monasteries. Worship of the Lord Krishna deity is still going on at Udupi according to the plans Madhvacharya established. Madhvacharya then for the second time visited Bhadrakashram. While he was passing through Maharashtra, the local king was digging a big lake for the public benefit. As Madhvacharya passed through that area with the disciples, he was obliged to help in the excavation. After some time, when Madhvacharya visited the king, he engaged the king in that work and departed with his disciples. So he converted the king, and the king acted as a servant. Often in the province of Ganga Pradesh, there were fights between Hindus and Muslims. The Hindus were on one bank of the river and the Muslims on the other. Due to the community tension, no boat was available for crossing the river. The Muslim soldiers were always stopping passengers on the other side. But Madhvacharya did not care for these soldiers. He crossed the river anyway, and when he met the soldiers on the other side, he was brought before the king. The Muslim king was so pleased with him, he wanted to give him a kingdom and some money, but Madhvacharya refused. While walking on the road, he was attacked by some dacoits, but by his bodily strength, he killed them all. That's all we know of that story. When his companion Satyatirtha was attacked by a tiger, Madhvacharya separated them by virtue of his great strength. When he met Vyasadeva, this is the second time going back, he received from him a Shalagram Shila known as Astamurti. After this, he summarized the Mahabharata. Madhvacharya's devotion to the Lord and his erudite scholarship became known throughout India. Consequently, the owners of the Sringera Math, established by Shankaracharya, became a little perturbed. At that time, the followers of Shankaracharya were afraid of Madhvacharya's rising power, and they began to tease Madhvacharya's disciples in many ways. There was even an attempt to prove that the disciplic succession of Madhvacharya was not in line with Vedic principles. A person named Pundarik Puri, a follower of the Mayavadi philosophy of Shankaracharya, came before Madhvacharya to discuss the Shastra. It is said that all of Madhvacharya's books were taken away, but later they were found with the help of King Jayashatta, ruler of Kumla. That's another long pastime I've heard before. But in discussion, Pundarik Puri was defeated by Madhvacharya. So this was the big Mayavadi philosopher, defeated by Madhvacharya. A great personality named Trivikramacharya, who was a resident of Vishnumangala, became Madhvacharya's disciple. And his son later became Narayanacharya, the composer of Sri Madhva Vijaya. After the death of Trivikramacharya, the younger brother of Narayanacharya took sannyas and later became known as Vishatirtha. So these are some of his followers and the line that continued after him. It was reputed there was no limit to the bodily strength of Purnaprajna Madhvacharya. There was a person named Kandanjari who was famed for possessing the strength of 30 men. Madhvacharya placed the big toe of his foot upon the ground and asked the man to separate it from the ground. But the great strong man could not do so even with great effort. Srila Madhvacharya passed from his material world at the age of 80. Okay, he lived 80 years while writing a commentary on the Aitreya Upanishad. For further information about Madhvacharya, one should read Madhva Vijaya by Narayanacharya. So this was a story, pastimes, I guess, in philosophy of Madhvacharya, written by his disciple. And then Prabhupada said, most of the information's purport is available from the South Kannada Manual on the Bombay Gazette. So that's the source material he used. Okay, so I know there are many pastimes and stories of Madhvacharya. He's a wonderful personality. Somewhat unusual in our line of acharyas, who we usually think of sort of as, you know, very humble, brahminical type of, you know. And here, of course, Madhvacharya was this very, very powerful person, you know, with great bodily strength, who could apparently jump miles and miles at a time, like Vayu. So, of course, these are all just sort of the external, wonderful attributes of him, but his contributions of writing these commentaries on Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and the Vaishnava literatures, and strongly preaching throughout India, defeating the Mayavadis, as we saw, defeating many of their most prominent scholars of the Shankarites, and really did tremendous work in establishing Vaishnavism, and then laid the philosophical groundwork for Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to come 200 years later and complete that work. So, all glories to Srila Madhvacharya, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Just brought it in.